This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning, I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. When one talks about Jews being chosen, if you were to ask somebody what Jews are chosen for, most people, even Jews, won't know. Some may even say Jews are God's chosen, almost like a favorite child, but that is simply not true. God loves all his children, and every single person has a God-given soul. What Jews are chosen for is to spread a message, to spread an idea, to spread morality and truth. And we do that in many ways. I believe that we are subconsciously drawn to the media, to Hollywood, to advertising, and to book writing. For that reason, I decided to chat to author Lemony Snicket, a.k.a. Daniel Handler. Good morning, Daniel. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for making the time. I just want our listeners to know, because more will probably know you as Lemony Snicket, but Daniel's books have gained significant popularity, critical acclaim, and commercial success worldwide, spawning a film, a video game, assorted merchandise, and a television series on Netflix. You have to go and watch the series. I'll give you details a little bit later. The main 13 books in his series, A Series of Unfortunate Events, have collectively sold more than, drumroll, 60 million copies, and they've been translated into 41 languages. Not a lot of authors can claim that. Sometimes Daniel writes under the name Lemony Snicket, and sometimes he writes under the name Daniel Handler, and apparently it makes little difference. So thank you very much. He's just released his latest book. It's called Poison for Breakfast. The book starts off, Daniel, we know numerous times in the book it's mentioned that breakfast is tea with honey.
Yes.
A piece of toast with cheese, one sliced pear, and an egg perfectly prepared.
Yes.
What do you have for breakfast?
Well, it really depends. That would not be an unusual breakfast for me. I do enjoy an espresso late in the morning when I'm done with all kind of morning ritual activities and exercise and I'm ready to start actually working. Then I need some bonus energy. But, you know, I'm 51 years old, so I've had many breakfasts in my day. And they're not always the same. When it gets cold, I want a larger breakfast. When it's hot, I sometimes forget to have breakfast. I have a son, and when he was young, we tried all kinds of breakfasts, you know, in the way that you try to get your child to eat. You know, during Passover, we have a lot of matzo brei, whatever the occasion calls for. But I'm not as strict as Mr. Snicket is in Poison for Breakfast. He has a breakfast invariably every day. That's not how I behave.
How would you define an egg perfectly prepared?
Well, there, I think Mr. Sicken and I share the same opinion. The book gets very opinionated about eggs. We should warn the audience, if you are sensitive to egg controversy, this might not be the book for you. He and I both enjoy a soft-boiled egg in the shell in a little egg cup with a small spoon with which to eat it. A poached egg is also delicious, being as not everyone has an egg cup lying around. More is the pity. This is something I think people should invest in. Yeah. And there's a small, I would have to say, rant in the book opposed to scrambled eggs, which I share his opposition to. I don't like a scrambled egg.
Do you think scrambled eggs are just failed eggs that tried to be something else but failed?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that's why the only time that scrambled eggs are delicious is when they're an ingredient in something else where you can't taste them at all. So when someone says, what do you mean you don't like a scrambled egg? Let me make you this wild mushroom omelet. And then I think, aha, see, you don't really like scrambled eggs either. You like wild mushrooms and you're coming up with an excuse to have them for breakfast.
So why not just have the wild mushrooms? I get it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like saying, you know, if you don't, oh, I don't like rice. And you say, well, I've made an enormous stew and I've put a tablespoon of rice in the bottom of it. It's not the same thing.
The book begins with breakfast, followed by a slip of paper that reads, you had poison for breakfast.
Yes. Well, that's why the ingredients in the breakfast are so essential in the book. Mr. Snicket gets a note saying, you had poison for breakfast and worried that he has been poisoned and will die soon. He investigates each ingredient in his breakfast, which leads to much philosophical and even spiritual, I would say, digression. So it starts out as a mystery book, and then, like all of my favorite mysteries, becomes more a pondering of more enormous and pressing mysteries than a tiny little detail like one's own death.
Daniel, have you ever received an anonymous slip of paper with a bewildering message on it?
I have. I mean, one thing about being a person visible in a culture is that you do hear from assorted anonymous types. Usually that would come electronically nowadays, although I have received much bewildering correspondence, and I have received many slips of paper. I also find slips of paper often on my walks. I like to walk around my city of San Francisco, and one thing that I'm on the lookout for is a scrap of paper that someone else has written. So I don't know if that's always written to me, but you get all kinds of, you know, you get notes that have been taped to doors a long time ago that say, like, come on in, I'm in the shower, or I'll be back in a minute. I like a shopping list. I like finding someone's old shopping list. I always hope that they've lost it after they've done all the shopping so that they're not standing in the aisle of the supermarket saying, oh, what was it? There was one other thing on the list and I can't remember what it is. So I enjoy a scrap of paper.
Or even worse, if they've lost their shopping list, then they have to go up and down each aisle wondering and looking for that one thing.
Right. They're trying to be prompted. Yeah. Yes. And then they get home and then they say, of course, tomatoes. I forgot to buy tomatoes. And it's too bad because everyone's coming over for tomato soup in 20 minutes.
Exactly. And they've ended up buying half the store, none of which were tomatoes.
Right. Everything that attracted their interest, but nothing that they needed.
Do you have breakfast in real life? Are you somebody who insists on having breakfast every day?
I do. I do like breakfast. I, like Mr. Snicket in the book, I also swim most mornings in the water here in San Francisco. And you're a fool if you dive into the water in San Francisco and you haven't eaten anything. You need some fuel. The water gets quite cold, particularly in the wintertime. And so you would be foolish to go without some sort of breakfast.
How far do you swim every day?
About a mile, somewhere between 3/4 of a mile and a mile. It's very invigorating. I often do it with my sister. In fact, when this interview is over, my sister will be picking me up and we will be diving into the water within an hour after this interview is concluded.
And where do you swim? Do you swim on the coast?
We swim in a little inlet, I would call it, in the bay that's called Aquatic Park. There are two swim clubs there that have been around since the late 19th century. They are housed in the same building, and they are rival swim clubs. My sister and I do not really understand the difference between them, but they have supposedly their own individual personalities, and it's a beautiful wooden building. There are also lovely boats there. Some people like to take boats out, but my sister and I swim, so we separate into our locker rooms, and then we meet at the top of these stairs, and we open the door, and we feel the cold morning air, and we wonder why on earth we are doing such a thing, and then we go down the steps, and we swim, and then we go back into the building for a shower and a sauna. For pandemic reasons, the showers and saunas were closed for a long time, and so my sister and I would go together in the car, and we would change our clothes outside in the shivering air. I had a small portable shower, which was no substitute for an actual shower, but was hot at least. So we would squirt each other with hot water. And my sister and I have always been close, but I think we became even closer during the pandemic days because this was a ritual that we did without fail every morning.
That's something that's really come out of this pandemic, is that it's made us prioritize certain relationships, which we've done quite willingly. I'm sure that it's the same with you.
Yes, although on the other hand, I was speaking to another writer and he said this thing that really rang true to me, that he said that during the pandemic, he's missed strangers more than he's missed his friends, because friends you keep up with and strangers you let fall or mere acquaintances. And he was using me as an example because he's a writer and he and I aren't really friends, but under normal circumstances, we'll run into each other at a literary festival every couple of years, maybe, and go have a coffee or a drink. And we weren't close enough to keep up that relationship when we were unable to see each other. But then we did this event together and we enjoy each other. And he was talking about that. And I think that's true too. Part of Poison for Breakfast talks about how I write my books which is often in libraries. Poison for Breakfast was written almost entirely in public libraries, but I write a lot in coffee shops also, and I really missed that during the pandemic. Even, I mean, for a while, nothing was open at all, and then even when things were open, you could get a cup of coffee, but you couldn't stay. And now, at least in California, it's just beginning to feel maybe halfway normal, where people are sitting at tables a little farther apart and maybe masked, but are beginning to work again in coffee shops. But I really miss that. Not only would I swim in the morning, but then I would zip up my bag of materials for writing, and I would take a walk around my block and re-enter my home as if I were commuting, because I missed so much going someplace else to do my work.
The pandemic has had a profound effect on people's mental health. Did it affect your writing at all?
I mean, I'm sure it must have. Poison for Breakfast was written before the pandemic, so I can't blame Matt on that. But it's the question that people always ask writers or artists of any stripe. Oh, did this affect you? You know, this world event or this event in your life? And I think we're all permeable membranes. How could it not have affected me? I did a lot of collaborative work during the kind of strictest times of the pandemic. I had some projects with musicians that previous to COVID were going very slowly because they were kind of on musicians' time. So they would travel around, and when we were both in the same town and we wanted to work, we would work a little bit. And then I think for musicians, it was one of the hardest. I think the pandemic was super hard on musicians, harder than it was on writers for sure. So musicians went from playing all over the place to saying, oh my goodness, I have nothing to do. Let's start meeting every week and working on these collaborations. So in that way, it affected me. But I think also the contemplation, kind of anxiety and contemplation going hand in hand, felt like a big part of the pandemic. And that's unusual. We think of contemplation as being a quiet time, a calm time. But I think that when this was certainly at its height, you couldn't help, your contemplation felt very anxious, which in many ways I think felt very Jewish to me. I think anxious contemplation might be a good title of the history of the Jewish people.
Exactly. Our neuroses have neuroses.
Yeah.
The accordion, one of the most difficult instruments to learn. When did you start learning it?
Well, I took piano lessons for my whole childhood. And when I got to the university, I was interested in playing in a band. And at that time, it was a strange moment in American pop music where no keyboard instruments were cool whatsoever. So I bought an accordion and began to fool around with it. So I had a little bit of an advantage. But the real advantage of playing the accordion is that you're probably the best accordion player anybody knows. And so I'm not very good at the accordion. But people invite me all the time because they think, oh, an accordion, why not? That'll be fun. And then I'll go do something with them. But if I played the guitar as well as I played the accordion, people would say, no one cares. No one would be interested. But because the accordion is kind of unusual, I think it's great. And then the accordion is an instrument that's hardly been standardized. It's really traveled all over the world with cultures of people who moved about a lot and brought it everywhere. And so that's fun too, is that there's so much music that accordion can fit into. I've played music that is, you know, sprung from all of the continents. You can play gypsy music and you can play tango music and you can play country western music and you can play pop music and you can play all sorts of traditional folk music, Japanese folk music I've played Egyptian folk music. And so that's really fun too, to kind of be able to fit right in, which to me also feels very Jewish, because I, as a Jew, come from a people who scattered all over the world, and we managed to fit in most places.
The accordion as an instrument is quite gothic, which just really lines up with the whole gothic theme behind your books. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say lonely, I would say, over gothic. I mean, I think a series of unfortunate events feels pretty gothic. All the Wrong Questions, which is the other Zicket series, feels more noir from the world of detectives of the 30s and 40s, maybe.
Okay, I'm not familiar with the genre of noir. What is noir?
Noir is kind of moody detective stories that that American and some French literature produced began in the 30s and 40s and still goes today. And it is, the kind of mystery I like, where there may be a plot mystery that starts, but then it spreads wide out. And it was very successful in literature and then very successful in film. If you've ever watched Humphrey Bogart as a detective, then you've watched a noir movie.
Okay.
And But I think the accordion is a lonely instrument. That's what I think it is. I think the sound is, it's very easy to produce a lonely sound on the accordion.
But I think that loneliness is maybe a theme of Gothic novels, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, in a traditional Gothic novel, a young woman goes to a remote location where she's been married off to some brute who's, brooding among the moors, and she has nothing to do all day. So, yeah, but I think really that loneliness is at the heart of so much literature, because it's almost impossible to write a novel and not be alone. You're alone working on it day by day, and I think you have a sensibility for which that job is suited. And so I think there's a kind of loneliness at the heart of all literature.
I'm speaking to author Lemony Snicket, a.k.a. Daniel Handler. Actually, I'm speaking to Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His 13-book set of A Series of Unfortunate Events has sold more than 60 million copies in 41 languages. Daniel, do you ever just think about those numbers? 60 million.
I try not to think about them.
no pressure.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite bewildering. When I never thought I would be a writer who had any mass popularity. I thought I was doing small, strange things, and it's been very surprising that there have been so many people who have responded to it. Yeah, it's quite humbling and dizzying in a way. So whenever someone recites that number as you just did, it feels like I'm peering over a precipice in some way. So I try not to think of it at all, because one who has sold a lot of copies to think about it.
So let me bring you back from that precipice. Do you recognize the responsibility that goes with writing material that is going to be devoured and enjoyed and loved and appreciated by so many people around the world? Or is that something that you can't really consider when you're writing?
I think the responsibility of all artists is to make something that feels true to their own selves. And that's the responsibility I feel. I think particularly books that are made for young people, it's hard not to think about your audience, because you're thinking about your language. If you're an illustrator, you're thinking about how things look, how the book will feel, all these very important things when you're reading when you're young. And so I feel a responsibility there not to get moralistic or simplistic or dishonest in the way that so much children's literature is. So I don't think my responsibility changes with how many copies that I sell, but I think that it's up to me to try to be as honest and clear as I can in my own work, to try to be the person who I am in the work that I make.
One element that I absolutely love, it actually causes laugh out moments from page to page, is how you define the meanings of words throughout the books and throughout the movies. It's fantastic. Why did you decide to do that? As far as I know, it's unique to you.
Well, when I was writing my first children's book, right away, just a couple paragraphs in, I wrote the word rickety. And I thought to myself, do young people know what rickety means? And then I thought, well, I guess I'll just tell them. And then as soon as I wrote that, I saw, well, what kind of narrator would stop the story to tell you what a word means? And then that seemed very funny and interesting to me, and also a little slippery, because of course words mean just kind of what we mean when we say them or when we write them. And so some of the definitions in the world of Lemony Snicket are very unreliable, but that's okay, because in general everything is unreliable, and Mr. Snicket is of the world, and the world is unreliable.
Definitions generally, I think, are unreliable. You know, windows used to mean something completely different to what it means today.
There are countless words whose definitions have changed. I just yesterday was using the word hullabaloo, and I thought, where does that come from? And I looked, and it comes from hello.
Really?
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very unexpected. It's
and
quite
just because it was like, hello, hello. Because if you were in a crowd, you would hear all these people saying hello, and that would describe the hullabaloo. And I thought that was quite lovely. Yeah, well, I assumed that the etymology of hullabaloo was not from English. You know, I thought, oh, this is going to be, I don't know what, Finnish or Chinese or something, just because the the vowel sounds didn't sound like English to me. And so I love that it came from hello.
I mean, it could also be your overweight aunt. I mean, not to say that you actually have an overweight aunt, but it could be an overweight aunt.
Who goes,
hello, baloo. You know, she's calling you in the crowd. That could also work, right?
In the Oxford English Dictionary, under hullabaloo, there was no mention of an overweight aunt, but that doesn't mean she wasn't there.
She
could have been erased from literary history.
She's there. Daniel, do you become Lemony Snicket when you write him, when you write as him, or is it just a name that you attribute?
I think it's a certain kind of point of view. And so when I'm writing a book, I can tell whether it's coming from Lemony Snicket or not, but I don't. Put on a cape or light a candle or do any personal rituals or anything like that. But I think it is a point of view, a type of looking.
Do you ever write something, look back at it and think, wow, I didn't know I thought that?
Yes, all the time. I think actually the best way you want to write is to lose track of all your self-consciousness. I think that's one of the reasons why I like to write in a library or in a cafe, is that I feel part of a crowd, so I feel like I disappear. And that's when I know I've done some good writing, is if I kind of wake up as if I've been spacing out or even napping. I wake up and I say, oh, look, I'm on page 6 already. This is good.
I'm speaking to author Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket. If you haven't seen the series on Netflix, it's called A Series of Unfortunate Events. Go and check it out. Daniel has just written a new book. It's just launched on the 1st of September, in fact, and it's called Poison for Breakfast. Go and read it. I promise you, you will have a giggle every single page. If you are a lover of language like I am, you are going to savor this book and read it again and again and again. It's one of those books that you're also going to want to buy for other people. I assure you, it's just that much pleasure. Daniel, when I was researching you, I read about how you came up with the name Lemony Snicket, which in and of itself is a lovely name. It's got a lovely, it just rolls off the tongue beautifully. So tell our listeners how you came up with the name for Lemony Snicket.
I was researching what turned out to be my first novel as Daniel Handler, which is called The Basic Eight. And parts of The Basic Eight make fun of kind of ridiculous cultural commentators, mostly right-wing commentators in America. And so I was contacting some ridiculous organizations and asking them to mail me their materials so I can mock them in my novel. And I was on the phone with one of them, and she said, of course, we'll mail you some materials. What is your name and address? And I thought, don't give them your real name and address. You're about to mock them, and then they'll have your contact info forever, and who knows what will happen. So I had to think quickly, though, and so I just uttered something else that wasn't my name, and I said, Lemony Snicket. And then there was a pause, and during the pause, I thought, out of all the things you could have said, why did you say that? All you had to do was say something that sounded like a name, and you said this ridiculous phrase instead. And then I thought, there's no way anyone is idiotic enough to think this is real. And then the right-wing woman turned out to be idiotic enough, and she said, is that spelled how it sounds? And I said, yes. And then I said, read it back to me, because I had no idea how it sounded like it was spelled. And I had a pen, and I wrote it down myself. And this was before I was writing anything for children or thought I would have any need of it, but it was a name that I liked a lot. Some friends for my birthday gave me some business cards that said Lemony Snicket on them that I used to give to people at a bar or a cafe to strike up a conversation. We made many Lemony Snicket cocktails when my friends would be at some restaurant where you give your name to the maitre d'. We would say Lemony Snicket just to hear the words Lemony Snicket shouted when our table was ready. And so then when I started writing these books, and precisely at that moment where I was defining Rickety and I was thinking, oh, there's a narrator here, and who is this narrator? I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to publish the books under the name of the narrator? And then I had this name laying around that I'd been having fun with.
Do you see God's hand in your story? You just happened to have this name lying around. And, you know, there's a path, there's a journey. Do you feel like in some ways you have been guided, or you've had help from outside?
Well, I don't think I did it alone. That's what I think. I think I've had a lot of tangible support from, I still have a wonderful family. I have a lovely wife. And I have a wonderful community. I have a powerful Jewish community. I have a powerful community of writers. I have a powerful San Franciscan community because I've lived in San Francisco almost all of my life. I don't know. I find it difficult to talk about the divine. I certainly don't shrug it off. I mean, it feels as soon as you start to talk about something as enormous as God, it feels if you're sure about it, then you're definitely doing it wrong. So I'm not sure. But my father used to like this joke that there's a flood and a man, to escape the flood climbs to the roof of his house and a boat comes to rescue him. And he says, God will rescue me. And the waters rise and he's at the very top and a helicopter comes and he says, I don't need the helicopter. God will rescue me. And the waters drown and he drowns. And then he meets God and he says, I thought you were going to rescue me. And God said, I did. I sent a boat and a helicopter. And so I think sometimes even something tangible and minor can perhaps be from an enormous source of which we're unaware.
Profound words, Daniel Handler. What this organization that you were contacting, this right-wing lunatic fringe, what did they send you?
They sent me, I mean, it's hard to remember exactly even which one it was because at the time I was gathering a lot of materials, but I liked the clumsy rhetoric of organizations that were dedicated to, fighting some large cultural force. I think that's interesting and funny. When someone says, oh, you know, dance music is a problem. We need to fight dance music. And they have some brochure about fighting dance music as if that were even possible, let alone, desirable. And so, I like that kind of rhetoric. I like, I mean, I think all my books are about this to some extent. Certainly Poison for Breakfast is about this. This is about trying to grapple with the bewildering world and that all language, all explanations, all ideologies in some way are ridiculous failures as we make our way through this very, very bewildering world. And I think if Poison for Breakfast has any theme, it's that when you are feeling bewildered, when you are feeling confused, that is actually the closest you are to understanding your own situation. So when you feel lost, this is the closest you are to feeling, to understanding the world, because the world is enormous and bewildering.
Again, very profound. Sometimes in a very tough situation, you have to throw your pieces up in the air and just see where they fall.
Yes, I think so. And to say, it is bewildering, rather than to say, oh, what can I do to sort this out to make something simple? To say, it isn't simple though, it's complicated. I think of that with individual issues that you're having with a loved one, or when you look at some large societal issue, when you say, how do we end bigotry? How do we end suffering? How do we end hunger? Right? How can we wipe a pandemic off the earth? Well, none of us want this here. What can we do? And it's good to remember it is bewildering. It is not simple. There are not three things you can do that'll work. There's not something that will work for everyone. It's a very complicated issue.
Do you ever look at the world and think, my gosh, how did we get here? It must have been a series of unfortunate events.
There's little else, I think, Ms. Kaelin, as I wanted this world. Particularly, you found me early in the morning, so of course I'm going to be particularly.
Do you have a favorite character?
I tend to like, and this is true not only in the books I've written, but in books that I read, I tend to like a minor character. So there are a few very small characters in my books, and I like thinking what a small part they play, and that obviously in their own heads, as all of us are, they're the hero of the story, of their own story, but we just see them going in. So there's a small character in a series of unfortunate events called Bruce. I like him a lot. There's a couple of waiters, important waiters in the Snicket books.
They just keep showing up.
Yeah, and I I've never waited tables, but I've always felt kind of a camaraderie with people who have, and my sister was a server for a while, so I think it comes from that. But yeah, I like a minor character.
I've also waited tables, and I have to tell you that you learn a lot about people when you wait on them.
I can't help but think that's true. Yeah. I think it would have been good for me to wait tables, sadly. I mean, I had various job, non-glamorous jobs for sure, but I just didn't have that specific one. But I think there's something very basic and yet very mannered about bringing someone else food.
Daniel, it's never too late. It's never too late to go and wait tables.
Well, although right now in San Francisco, the restaurant situation is, of course, trying to get unrickety following the pandemic. So I think the last thing they want is an older man who's never done it before, but maybe someday.
Just do it for one day. Tell them you'll pay them to let you do it.
Oh, please. I have a child. I've been a waiter for one day.
What are the other jobs that you've done?
They were all pretty much miserable office jobs. So nothing very glamorous about them, answering phones and filing things. I started getting jobs that were a little adjacent to writing. I worked for a literary agency for a short period of time. I worked as a film critic for a tiny newspaper in New York. I wrote some radio scripts for some radio shows, things like that. None of them were really writing, but they had the shape of writing. And it was interesting to peer into a world in which you could be close to writing without actually being a writer, which is kind of how I thought I would end up. But then I got lucky.
I don't think you got lucky. I think you just were very persistent and you have this enormous talent. When you wrote for radio, did your sense of humor come through, your wit?
Not very much. I wrote for a radio production house and we made shows that were, this was in America, but we made shows that were largely broadcast in Japan. And the things that I wrote were not anything that you would think of as being written, but because they were being packaged and broadcast, you know, so I would just say two facts about the song that we just played or try to link the two songs or anything like that. If you were listening to the radio, the idea was that it would just sound like an impromptu DJ. But they were scripted. So they weren't, they could be mildly funny, but also they had to be, kind of innocuous, and it was all to fit an American company's idea of what Japanese people would want from Americans. So it was probably three times removed from what anyone wants. And it was also, we were mostly promoting music that I didn't like. So I was afraid of trying to be too funny because it would seem like I was mocking music that I was not enjoying.
I can see how that was unfulfilling for you. It's interesting you mentioned Japan. I was actually researching the other day, and Japan has introduced AI newsreaders. It's crazy.
I mean, it seems, given there's so much on-screen information that is now being produced by AI, so I guess having it read isn't really that different from... Yeah. But
I'm speaking to author Daniel Handler. He's the author of A Series of Unfortunate Events. Go and watch the series on Netflix. I promise you, you won't regret it. You will love the dialogue. You will love the intelligence of it. Show it to your kids. Bring in your grandparents. He's also written his most recent book is called Poison for Breakfast. Every page is a giggle. If you love the language, the story is intriguing. It is clever and, go and check it out. Go and check it out. It's available on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Daniel, I would like to talk about a series of unfortunate events. Let's talk about the three Baudelaire orphans, Violet, Class, and Sunny. Did you have to give them such a hard time? They're orphans, darn it.
Well, I don't think there'd be much pleasure in reading a book in which not much happens to three people, and they had an overall fine time. I mean, when I was a child, I think the two dominant stories, the types of stories that came into my life were books that I was reading. And I think like most young boys, I liked a book where a lot of things happened. If there were witches, if there was swashbuckling, if there was a shipwreck, that was my idea of a good time. And then also, my father's family fled Germany in 1939. Some of them got out and some of them didn't. And as a result, my extended family was not close on a family tree, but we were close geographically and emotionally to each other. And so on holidays, I would gather with a wide assortment of cousins. And the reason why the assortment was so wide was that so many people had not survived. And so the story of how all of us were literally sitting at that table was told to me a lot. And that story was full of suffering and adventure, of narrow escapes and, you know, a scheme that worked over here and then a scheme that wouldn't work over here. And I think the, that dire urgency that was mixed with the more far-flung adventures that I was reading on the page is what produced Lonely Snicket. So yes, I mean, in my mind, the Baudelaire orphans are Jewish. And so of course they have suffering.
Yes. What they don't have is guilt though. So that's made me question, are they really Jewish if they're not carrying this guilt?
Well, I would say over the course of those 13 volumes, one thing that happens to the Baudelaires is as they get older and as they get deeper and deeper in the world that is causing them so much strife, they become participants in it and they do more and more questionable things. So they actually have a lot of moral arguments about what it is that they ought to do, because as they get older, they get less innocent and less harmless. And so I think they do have guilt. You know, it's not kind of stereotypical Jewish guilt of like, oy gewalt, my mother. But I think they feel the weight of the world.
Sorry, excuse me.
That's okay. I understand that you would want to cough when you hear the weight of the world. Thought, oh goodness, the weight of the world.
I'm so enjoying speaking to you. Seriously, if you ever come to South Africa, you and your wife and your son, Otto, you have places at my table. You'll come to me for Shabbos. I'll take you to Soweto. We'll go all
yes,
around.
Yes, please.
I would love
Thank
you to
you. I've never been Daniel. To South Africa, and it is high on my list.
But I'm really loving talking to you. You've got the best sense of humor. Just getting back to the Baudelaire children. Sometimes it's also the story of Jews, almost a Jewish history, because it's just relentless. This happens and then that happens and then that happens and then that happens. You know, we think about the Holocaust. It wasn't unique. It's been happening for centuries and centuries, perhaps not on the same scale, but it's just
well,
relentless.
Well, yes. And I mean, and traveling to the next place, which is what the Baudelaires do. When something becomes intolerable and they manage to escape, they go someplace else where they think will be safe. This is their entire journey. And I think that's a very Jewish journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were talking to me from South Africa. I'm talking to you from California. Neither of these places are where Judaism came from. And why are we both in these locations? Because our people fled.
And wherever we land, it has its own challenges. And sometimes we have to move on again.
Wherever we land, we start our own radio show and we do very well for ourselves. So you're an inspiration.
What's interesting about the Baudelaire children when we're talking about the guilt is that there's a principle in life in that we get to choose who our teachers are. When people are unkind to us, we can decide whether we're going to learn from them or whether we are not going to let them be our teachers. What's your thought?
I think that's very true. And it reminds me of something that I like to talk about in literature a lot, where there's often arguments over what kind of literature should be canonized. Should we continue to revere this author? Is this no longer a relevant book? Is this book even harmful? And we used to think it was doing somebody good. And in children's literature, this is even more intense because there's more of a panic about getting the wrong words in front of children. What I always say is that the literary canon is the one that you make yourself. It is your favorite books. That's the literary canon. And particularly when you're young, if you read and you love a book, it doesn't matter to you if this book won an award or if people love it all over the world or if no one's ever heard of it, if it's considered the author's best book or anything like that. That's not interesting to you. And in fact, I think as you grow older, that also should not particularly be interesting to you. I think that you make a space for yourself in your reading life by building this canon. And it's the same in every other art form, right? What is the music that is important to you, right? It's the song that has always made you cry. It's the music that makes your family get up and dance, right? This is the music that means something. And if someone said, there's really better music over here, or if you think about it, that music isn't very good, that's not going to do anything for you. And I think it's the same with people, right? The people who are most important in your life are not going to be the people who have all won the Nobel Prize or anything like that. They're just going to be individuals who've meant something to you. And I think that the way they mean something to you is that something happens and you look at them and you say, yes, this is someone who's in my company, or no, this is someone, you know, from whom I'd like to be distant.
I was actually thinking about you as a father and the series of unfortunate events you started writing. When was it, 1999, or was that when it was published?
Yeah, I started writing them in 1998. The first one was published in 99, yeah.
And then 2003, you have this gorgeous baby born. Right, Otto. Did it change anything in your writing now that you were writing as a father and you're writing about these three orphans?
I mean, again, how could it not change me, of course? But I think particularly when he was young, it was very helpful to me, because when you have a baby, you know, you spend a great deal of time brainstorming on things that can go wrong with your baby. Right. That's, I think, one of the biggest changes of parenting, is that when you have a 2-year-old and you walk into a room with a 2-year-old, your eyes are everywhere. Is there a vase that's going to fall? Is there food? Is there a plug? Is there a sharp edge? Is there an animal? Is there, you know, is this somewhere where I can let go of this person's hand and they can go running around? Or is this something where I have to hold them close? And before you have a child, you don't think about that at all. You just walk into a room and think, you know, where's the gin? And so to have my job be brainstorming about terrible things that could happen to children, and then have a child that I had, you know, that I would carry around and think, oh my goodness, what if this happens, was, I think, extremely helpful to me.
Daniel, are any of your characters based on real people? And please don't tell me that books write themselves. They do not write themselves.
They do not write themselves. And I always think that question is funny, because, I mean, the only way you could create a character is if you knew people. And so, yeah, there's no one who is exactly the same person, but I've just changed the name or something. But little bits and pieces of people, what they say, what they look like, what their mannerisms are, stories that they tell me. I mean, this is everything that goes into everything. It's like thinking. I mean, writing is like thinking. You walk around and you think about things. You think about a story someone told you 12 years ago, or something you saw that you can't quite get out of your eyes. I think that's where books come from.
And yet there are people who don't, who are completely unaware of that. You know, when you're noticing different elements of different people, different behaviors, a tick here, a nuance there. There are people who are completely oblivious to that.
I mean, I don't know if that's true. I think that if you're something like a writer, you're honing yourself to notice things so you can do it. I often think that people just don't have the words for what it is that they're thinking about, particularly if it's something unusual or something that they feel nervous about admitting. And it isn't that they don't notice it. It's that they've noticed something else and that they've been told it's not relevant to the conversation. You know, when you're a child, you have all these concerns that you don't articulate, or if you do, people don't understand them because they're your set of concerns. And I think historically we see all kinds of people who have been welcome in the conversation and unwelcome in the conversation. So I think everybody notices something. I think everybody has something to say.
Daniel, you heard in my intro talking about Jews being chosen. Now, if you go to your average Jew, or you go to even your average Christian, and you say, what are Jews chosen for? They say, God's chosen people. You're God's special people. But that's not true at all. All people are God's special people. And I know that talking about the divine is not something comfortable to you. But what we were chosen for as a people is to disseminate ideas. What ideas would you say your books disseminate?
I would say that they disseminate the idea that we are all of the world, and that what is painful to us, what is terrifying to us, what makes us sad, is as much a part of us as anything else. And that you can't go through this world without hurting someone. You can't go through this world without making someone weep on your behalf. And that, so that when you are weeping, when it is your turn to weep, that you should remember that it was also your turn to make someone weep.
That's beautiful. And that is where we leave it this morning. Daniel Handler, it has been an absolute and utter delight.
Well, it has been a delight. You were worth getting up early for, Ms. Kalen.
Jeez, you're a keeper.
Well, now that I know there's a place for me at your table, I want to keep up this charming relationship that we have.
Anytime. You know where my contact details are. But thank you very, very much. I wish you all the success in the world.
Well, thank you, and I wish it of you.
Thank you so much. I wish you and your family Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. I guess, well, it isn't that time here yet, but we're getting there.
Thank you so much. That was author Daniel Handler. His 13 book set of A Series of Unfortunate Events has sold more than 60 million copies in 41 languages. If you want to get out a message about morality, about the way to behave, about truth, about loyalty, about generosity, about supporting one another, about emanating goodness, how better to do it than through books? If you'd like to watch his series, it's called A Series of Unfortunate Events. It's a Netflix series. It's not the movie. He did work a little bit on that, but the series is actually more true to his books. It is hilarious. And adults and children will see different level movies. I highly, highly recommend it, and I would love your feedback once you've seen it. Thank you so much for joining me this week. I will be back with more Community in Conversation next week. From myself, Kathy Kayla, I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom.
It's a Community in Conversation. Join Kathy Kayla every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.